The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
Mr. Speaker, on Friday at Chequers, the Cabinet agreed a comprehensive and ambitious proposal that provides a responsible and credible basis for progressing negotiations with the EU.
After the Chequers showdown and a weekend of stewing, Boris Johnson and David Davis finally jumped ship.
It would have been me that had to carry it out, me that had to present it to Parliament, me that had to make it work in the European Union. And frankly, if I don't believe in it, I'm not the best person to do it.
Civil war is breaking out on the Tory benches, but Theresa May staggers on. Only to greet Donald Trump, who's in Britain this week and already creating mayhem with a hostile newspaper interview.
I believe that the people in the UK, they like me a lot.
As the president arrives in a country he describes as somewhat in turmoil, is this his first ever understatement? But first this week, the Brexit dream is dying, wrote Boris Johnson in his resignation letter to the Prime Minister on Monday. It was a step up from his language at Chequers when he described the Brexit proposal as a big turd. He wasn't first out of the blocks, though. David Davis got in earlier with his resignation, complaining about a progressive dilution of previous agreements. Well, to discuss it all, I'm joined by my panel, Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, Madeline Grant of the Institute of Economic Affairs, and the Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland. Ian, why did these big two cabinet beasts feel they had to go, and why now?
I think the crucial question really is, why did David Davis feel he had to go? Because when you get to Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson went because David Davis went. And that sort of created a bit of complication in terms of how he likes to try and operate his power base within the Tory party. David Davis, I pretty much take it his word on this stuff. I mean, you know, I assume that he really didn't think he could sell this thing. He thought it over for a while and then stepped down. I don't think there's much more complication to it than that. His strategy, he was quite clear actually on the Today programme on Monday. And I think it's probably the most viable strategy for the ERG, the European Research Group of sort of hard Brexiters in the Tory party, which is not so much, can I stop this, but can I stop further concessions? And by stepping down, I think he's in a better position to do that.
This far and no further. And to some extent, he thinks that Brussels will look at his resignation and say, you know, gosh, Theresa May have gone as far as she can go. There's a bit of that, isn't there?
I don't think they'll think that. Or insofar as they do, that just means that we're going to have no deal. Because if this is as far as we go, no deal is possible. They will, however, be very kind to her. You can expect warm words at least over the next 2 weeks. Because whenever she looks like she's in trouble from that side, Brussels are very, very helpful. They shore up the support and start saying some pleasant things. But those pleasant things will dry up because the plan itself is completely bananas.
Says the man who spent quite a lot of time yesterday reading it. I know. We'll get on to that. Jonathan, usually these kinds of cabinet resignations spark a major crisis, don't they? Or they're designed to. Did Davison Johnson miscalculate? She's refilled the places on the front benches and she's sailed on to some extent.
I mean, I think in a way they did, because she is like, you remember the old Superman, the sort of bizarro world where everything that should be is the opposite. And Theresa May doesn't
in
have
that.
we've all been living in that for over 2 years. That's true. But Theresa May is particularly like that, in the sense that what is normally weakness, because she's so absolutely weak, what would normally make a regular prime minister even weaker, had a perverse effect of making her look strong. And I thought that was in two ways. First is the idea that for once she was taking a stand and holding a position that other people then disagreed with. And that was a contrast. But also, as you said, it did mean she got a chance to be rid of two difficult, and particularly in Boris Johnson, a very difficult cabinet colleague, and has got a cabinet that is just slightly more in her image. And I thought there was something sort of interesting about the Brexiteers complaining afterwards, saying, well, now this is an outrage. We've been betrayed. We've only got Remainers in these four positions. Well, it was you who quit. You know, you were the guys who walked out. And she then took advantage of that opportunity and put in other people. So I think and it showed in a way a kind of perverse confidence that she could put in Jeremy Hunt at the Foreign Office and Dominic Raab at Dexiu, because she was saying, although, of course, he's, on the other side of that argument. But I think it did show a kind of confidence that she was saying, I don't now have to play that numbers game of balancing and accommodating all of you. And instead, I can make it more in my image. That said, as the week has gone on, I think it is looking harder for her because and we'll feel it, I think, this weekend, the grassroots do appear to be sour on the deal she brokered at Chequers.
That's right, isn't it? Madeline, below cabinet level, there's been MPs abusing each other on Twitter and all kinds of things, and you know, lots of briefing going on. Is the party in meltdown?
I definitely think that
what Theresa May has done is shown a great desire to keep her own position as it currently is, but a real lack of understanding of what it is that her own grassroots members actually want. I think as we saw at the last local election, you may remember John Curtis, who, as we know, is the only pollster that anyone can trust on anything. He basically laid bare the extent to which support for the Conservative Party has crystallised around the Leave vote. So though it might keep her position in the short term, anything that is seen to be chipping away at a hard Brexit is going to be seriously damaging to Theresa May in the long term.
And she's going to be surrounded by senior figures, including Johnson and Davis, very much making that argument publicly, isn't she?
Yes, and now that they've been liberated, they've been sent back to the backbenches, they can advocate more with the ERG, and they can do basically things that were prevented to them by virtue of being cabinet ministers. So I think it may have bought her a little more time, but I think it may have stored up a huge number of additional problems for the long term.
Well, this week seems to have marked a drawing of lines in what's now become a vicious internal war in the Conservative Party. For those with leadership ambitions, it's as much about winning over potential Tory voters as delivering a workable deal. So what do those voters think? I'm joined on the line now by Matthew Goodwin, Professor of Politics at the University of Kent, who's been studying the issue. Now, Matthew, what can we say about what Tory voters are thinking about Brexit and how that's changed in the 2 years since the referendum?
I think the first point to make is that it's really, really important that we understand this is not the same Conservative Party electorate that was behind David Cameron. In the 2 or 3 years since that era, the Conservative Party electorate at large has changed in a number of important ways. It's become more socially conservative, more traditionally socially conservative, stronger views on things like immigration and law and order. It's become more pro-Brexit. It's also become more working class and less well-educated. And those changes partly reflect the way in which today's Conservative Party has hoovered up a lot of former UK Independence Party voters. But it also reflects the way in which the Conservative Party brand, a more pro-Brexit brand, has appealed to groups in British society that might ordinarily have supported the Labour Party. So we're seeing what you might look at as a partial realignment in British politics, and that's going to have all kinds of consequences for the Conservative Party going forward.
OK, and what do those voters then, if we've got this sort of new electoral sort of constituency, as it were, how much does it matter to them what kind of Brexit we get? Because the argument that you're hearing, whether it's from the Boris Johnsons or, you know, those sort of Brexiters in Parliament at the moment, is voters will feel incredibly betrayed if we do the sort of soft Brexit that Theresa May is now proposing.
So if you look at the Conservative Party electorate today, there's no doubt, based on what we know from big credible surveys like the British Election Study and other forms of data, that most of those voters are more in line with what you might call the Boris Johnson vision of Brexit or even the Jacob Rees-Mogg vision of Brexit than the Theresa May vision of Brexit. The average Conservative voter tells us in surveys, for example, that they think it's more important to stop freedom of movement than it is to guarantee ongoing free trade with the European Union. A large majority of that electorate also tells us that they are stridently pro-Brexit. They want to leave the single market. They want to leave the customs union. And of course, we also need to remember that those views then escalate again in a more pro-Brexit direction among the Conservative Party members, not just the voters. So there are a number of pressure points now that are going to exert themselves on Theresa May. And, you know, the big million-dollar question for the Conservative Party also is, to what extent does it want to carry this electorate forward into future general elections? Because these wins among traditional social conservatives and pro-Brexiteers are coming at the expense of gains among the more liberal middle class, university graduates and younger voters. So there are strategic dilemmas all over the place for the Conservatives.
Huh. And you could probably make a sort of polling case for different approaches, couldn't you? You can imagine a sort of Johnsonite or a Rees-Moggite coming along and saying, you know, we need to keep those voters we had in 2017, and to do that we need to stop migration. And you can imagine a different case being made by a more sort of centrist candidate about the others that you could reach out to.
I think that there's certainly an argument within the more liberal wing of the Conservative Party that's saying, look, actually, if the party sticks with these more stridently pro-Brexit voters, then the future is going to look quite bleak for the Conservative Party. And there's no doubt that the Conservatives have had disastrous losses in London and, you know, where I teach in Canterbury, for example, losing that seat for the first time since the 1800s. But there is also a strategic question here about, you know, what can the party do in the immediate electoral cycle between now and the next general election? And I think some Conservatives are asking themselves the question of, well, will they ever win back millennials in the next 4 or 5 years? Will they ever win back the liberal middle class in the next 4 or 5 years? Will they ever be able to get back into London constituencies in the next 4 or 5 years? So there's a short-term dilemma for the Conservative Party, which is what vision of Brexit is going to triumph. But there is also a longer-term dilemma for the Conservatives, which is how can they build this big catch-all coalition that can get them back into big majority territory?
And just one last question, Matthew. Where do Labour put themselves on this? They're in a bit of a strategic bind too, aren't they?
Well, in a way, the Labour Party has the opposite problem. The Labour Party at the election last year polled strongest in urban constituencies, the university towns, middle class constituencies among more liberal minded Britons. But at the same time, it did noticeably less well in more pro-Brexit, working class and less well educated constituencies. And so the debate that we had before the referendum about the left behind in Britain, well, in a way, that's cast a very long shadow over British politics, because the Labour Party is still struggling to win over that left behind section of the electorate that is blue collar, that is pro-Brexit, that is deeply anxious over immigration. And of course, the Labour Party too cannot win an overwhelming commanding majority with just liberal middle class urban voters. It needs those blue collar and also in some cases more traditional socially conservative voters as well if Jeremy Corbyn's going to win a convincing majority. So, you know, a lot of groups are up for grabs, and both of the parties are facing a really, really important crunch period in the history of their electorate.
Matthew Goodwin, thank you very much. Well, you can follow all our political reporting and analysis every day at theguardian.com/politics. Ian, we now have the long-awaited Brexit white paper, not quite the one that David Davis was working on. Quite a few of his chapters seem to have been junked, I think. But you've read it. What's in it and what isn't?
So the Chequers statement was a pretty good definition, actually, a pretty good summary of what it involved. It's about, I think it's 104 pages. It could have been pretty easily cut down to about five. It's the sort of statement that you would have expected to get just before they triggered Article 50. So an opening position statement with the EU. You know you're going to have to give a lot of ground from where she is there. It sort of occasionally acknowledges problems, but then doesn't grapple with them. Other times it just pretends those problems don't exist, either because they just really want to act as if they don't, or because they simply are not aware that they exist yet on several technical issues. The worst passage by far remains the bit on customs partnership, which has this extraordinary sort of sci-fi literature bent to it, where they say, well, look, we're going to come up with these formulas for how we collect this here, and then at some point in the production process, maybe halfway through, we would figure out where the product is being made, and we would send this back there and put that over there, and it's just absolutely insane. She then chucks a bunch of the Max Fax stuff that the Brexiters like on top of that for
the
rest of world
trade.
The
idea of using technology to try and
magical unicorn solutions that will be invented sometime in the future to make sure that customs checks don't need to take place. And there it goes very, I mean, there's one section, a whole section where she starts talking about artificial intelligence and how we're going to use this for the borders. And you suddenly think, like, you know, at this point, you guys have gone completely off the reservation. There's no control here at all. So on the two points, first one is single market and goods. She doesn't have a good story to tell there. She must know she needs to move on to services. But if she does so, the party will lose its mind even more than it does now. And on the second of the customs partnership, it is delusionary and fantastical to an almost extraordinary degree.
Johnny, it seemed clever in the wake of Chequers to some extent, didn't it? She seemed to have sort of kept everybody on board. But it's a sort of halfway house, isn't it? It isn't going to please anyone, is it? Labour will simply say, why don't you just, you know, remain inside some sort of customs union?
Yeah, no, it was one of these strange things, again, this sort of odd parallel worlds we exist in, where Chequers was billed as some big breakthrough and there's finally a deal. And of course, all it ever was a patched together starting position to be rejected by Brussels. And so it has no, it doesn't have any kind of existence in the real world. It's not a credible plan. But I agree, politically, it is a bit of an orphan, because Remainers will not like it, because it is, as you say, it's not even in the customs union, which is the sort of weakest Remain position. And obviously, as we've seen all week, Brexiters won't like it. And therefore, there is a kind of worst of all worlds aspect of it. And so you do wonder how long it can survive, really. And I think your point about Labour is a good one, because as so often with these discussions about Brexit, I think it really does come back to Labour and the opposition and what they will eventually do. Because in a way, every one of her plans, given her non-majority and given the size of the Rees-Mogg group, every one of her plans does require Labour votes if it is to go through the Commons. And yet, what evidence is there for, you know, just politically, not on the merits or the technicalities, for why Labour would ever vote any kind of deal through? And so I think we're always in that precipice where, at that moment where there is no Commons majority, does that therefore mean we leave with no deal, or does it mean we don't leave? And to me, that is the big existential question hovering over all the apparently technical arguments. I can't quite see what the answer to that is.
And Madeline, what about the big issue of free movement that really exercises some of the Brexiters, and we know some of the voters too? How's that been tackled?
Well, it seems that they say that it's very much, they will bring an end to free movement of people. But at the same time, it does rather seem like the kind of cherry-picking approach that the EU has tended to reject in the past. They'd done some polling, I think it was Servation last week, that found that of all the various red lines that could be crossed, the one that would go down least well with the Brexiteers would be any relaxation of the claims made on freedom of movement. And from what I understand, there has been huge pushback from Sajid Javid in the Home Office against allowing any kind of compromise solution. So yeah, it's very difficult to see how she would be able to sell that to the Conservatives at a grassroots level.
And the other aspect, Ian, is this idea of a common rule book, isn't it? That's one of the things that's exercised Johnson and Davis quite a bit, we know.
Because it's not a common rule book, it's the EU's rule book that we're going to sign up to. The whole of the document is full of these bits where they act as if it's two equal partners. They pretend that the sort of international arbitration body, the independent sort of body that we would both go to sort out these rules, is like two mates meeting up going, oh, what rules have you got? What rules have you got? Let's make sure they're aligned. And it's not. It's the EU turning up like they do with Norway and Switzerland, going, this is what we're doing with the chemicals in cars. This is what we're doing with the way that electricity works in sockets. Now you have to update your rules, and you can bring in your civil servants and you can tinker with it at the technical level in terms of implementation, but this is what we're going to do and now you have to do it too. Norway does have an answer to that, has section 102 of the EEA agreement, which basically allows it to just veto and block off that part of the agreement. They once almost did this with postal services. They got terribly upset about post and almost did this, but they never do it. And they never do it because they don't want to lose market access. Now, Theresa May's got the same plan here of going, look, we'll have this, we'll have a chat, then we'll have a consultation, then we'll have a ruling, then we'll have a fine. And after the fine, you can then block off that part of the agreement if you don't like it. We will never, ever do it, because just like Norway, we won't want to lose access to the market.
Yeah, and I think that's what some of the Remainers in Cabinet think, isn't it? It's fine, we'll erect this complicated process, which in theory leaves us an option, leaves us the sovereignty to be able to change our rules. But in practice, that argument will be incredibly hard to make because we would miss out on trade. Madeline?
Yes, I would say on that, I completely agree with everything that Ian has said there. The Brexiteers are particularly angry about this common rulebook proposition, because what that would mean is essentially too much regulatory alignment, which would then make it very difficult to strike new trade deals with third countries. And so they would view it, again, as the worst of all possible worlds, Brexit, because it involves being a rule taker without having the freedom to realise some of the benefits of leaving.
And what's so odd about it is they think therefore the solution is to break completely away and not take those rules, whereas the other option is to stay with access to our biggest, nearest market and have a say in the rules. But of course, that is called being a member of the European Union. But I think what the whole process has done has actually revealed this huge sort of gap in the kind of mindset of the Brexiteers, which is to accept that we are part of this very big integrated European economy. For their logic to work, they need to pretend that isn't the case, rather than accept the fact that it is the case, and you'd rather have a say in that than not.
That may well be the case, but the fact is that we did have a vote to leave the EU, and any betrayal of that would be, I think, a deep betrayal of democracy. It would involve a very large swathe of people who may not have been involved in politics for years and years finally being involved in the process and then seeing their wishes being disrespected by the elites. I think that would be really bad for the kind of social contract.
Yeah, no, one of the things I'm sort of wrestling with a bit now is I think a lot of leavers have given thought to no deal. I don't think remainers have given sufficient thought to no Brexit. And people on the remain side of the argument do need to think about what would happen if the sheer implosion of the illogic of the Brexit case means that Brexit doesn't happen. I agree with you, Madeleine. I think there would be a kind of democratic crisis because people would think that they what they voted for hadn't happened. The fact that what they were sold was on a false prospectus wouldn't reduce that feeling. There would be huge antipathy and rage. And I think if no Brexit is a scenario that's possible, just like no deal is, we do need to start giving some thought to that.
But of course, that is where the idea of another referendum comes from, that you cannot just stitch this stuff up in Winchester. If there's going to be a change, if there's going to be remain at the end of this thing, and it is not impossible by any measure that that doesn't happen, it has to be because the final deal as it is made is put down in front of people again in order for them to look at it. There has to be a new stamp of democratic legitimacy on it. If it is a backroom stitch up, I do accept that we would be in terrible trouble.
But then there is a risk that would become an incredibly bitter campaign, isn't there? You would get contested views about whatever deal we end up with would mean. You would get Project Fear allegations. You would get we've had enough of experts writ large.
But everything feels very bitter right now. I mean, it doesn't feel like we're in a great place. And the one advantage it would have is that you are looking at something that is on the table. You would see the terms of the deal rather than having that sort of paintbrushstroke, dreamed up unicorn land stuff that we got during the original. There would actually be arguably a bit more content to it.
Madeleine, I'm interested in, we've talked about David Davis and Boris Johnson. Obviously, some of the prominent Brexiters, Liam Fox, Michael Gove, have remained inside the tent. Why have they accepted, you know, what Davis and Johnson clearly felt they couldn't live with? And can they stay?
Well, I think Davis was a very particular case because, of course, his team had been preparing a different white paper that was systematically ignored and blindsided, and then Ollie Robbins and the PM went behind their back to produce a different white paper. So I think under those circumstances, you would look utterly ridiculous not resigning. Whereas I'm not quite sure what's going on with Liam Fox. I think generally the Brexit faction are not quite sure what's going on there. I think Michael Gove may be making his own manoeuvres. Then there's clearly a lot of game theory going on in Westminster right now that I would be loath to try and comment on.
Heaven forbid that either of them are thinking about anything other than the interests of Great Britain.
Incidentally, on that, I mean, feeling, because we began with the resignations, and my feeling at the time was, as long as Gove doesn't go, she's okay. And that is because, and it's strange given I know plenty of Guardian readers will feel a special kind of loathing for Michael Gove, but I think there is just something a little bit more credible about him 2 years on after the referendum than the other two. It's partly because he is quite a capable and effective minister. And I thought so there was just something in my mind that was a sort of critical mass test. And as long as he thought and he could live with and actually go out on Mar as an advocate for the Chequers deal, I thought she could write off, in a way, the likes of Johnson and Davis as, you know, ego in the first case and sort of, you know, David Davis being David Davis in the other case. And it was OK. But I think if she were to lose Gove, I think that would be a problem, just as it was for Cameron when Gove joined the Leave campaign in 2016.
Yeah, and that actually gives him extraordinary leverage from here on in, doesn't it?
I think it does. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you can follow all our political reporting and analysis every day at theguardian.com/politics. Now, as protesters gather around an inflatable Donald Trump as a baby balloon in London, US military helicopters buzz overhead and Westminster is ablaze with reaction to an extraordinary interview the president has given to the Sun newspaper. He effectively killed off the chances of a post-Brexit trade deal, saying he advised May to negotiate Brexit differently. He praised Boris Johnson and said May's rival would make a great prime minister. All this after a NATO meeting in which he accused Germany of being totally controlled by Russia. Johnny, it's been another week, hasn't it, where the usual conventions and norms of international relations have taken a pounding from Trump.
It has, and that now has become the norm. I mean, it is a new normal, and we should probably stop talking about the usual conventions and norms because under this president, they don't exist. It's easy to get sort of hung up on the protocol, and in a way, I think that suits Trump because it enables him to pose as this sort of no bullshit truth teller who is somehow doesn't go along with, and you look at the Sun coverage just now with this interview, and it does sort of praise him as this plain speaking guy who doesn't do all the sort of fancy pants diplomacy stuff. I think that that works well for him. What's more important than the protocol and the sort of politeness is the actual strategic objective here. And however, you know, scattershot he is, random he seems, there's always one direction of travel with him, which is essentially undermining the liberal democratic Western order that has held since 1945 and helping the forces of populism, reaction, and authoritarianism, particularly associated with Russia. And that is the overall big picture point. Whatever he does will undermine international institutions, the European Union this week, but NATO this week, and will help the forces against those, which are centrally Vladimir Putin and his gangster regime in Moscow. And that is the one sort of golden thread that runs through all of Trump's apparently sort of random moods. And so when people sort of say he's throwing a tantrum or whatever, I think that is to misunderstand him. He can be contradictory within the same sentence, but there is an overall strategic thrust there. And I think that is the danger that he poses. And it's much more serious than just diplomatic niceties.
And Madeleine, it feels like a deliberate attempt to undermine the Prime Minister at a very difficult time for her. What do you make of it?
I think that might well be true. I don't doubt that Trump and Theresa May personally seem to have a pretty acrimonious relationship. But I would say that when Trump said what he said about a deal with the US being up in the air, that to me is a slightly different story, because that is simply an expression of what current US policy is. It's not necessarily an attempt. It's not. I think it is subtly different to when President Obama came over and said that Britain would be at the back of the queue for a trade deal. I think it's perfectly legitimate for a potential future trading partner to highlight the fact that if we remain too closely wedded to EU institutions, it will be difficult to have the kind of freedom to change our regulations that we'd need to strike a new trade deal.
So you're saying it wasn't legitimate for Obama to make essentially the same point?
No, I think it's different, because that was a clear attempt to influence an election, and there was that we have a kind of omerta, a kind of understanding about not interfering in elections. But what Trump did was simply say this: if this deal goes ahead, it's likely to scupper our chance of a trade deal. To me, I think that is pretty important information that we would want to know.
It's exactly the same thing that Obama did. He came over and said, look, if you leave and you try to get a trade deal, you're going to be at the back of the queue. I didn't like him saying that. I thought he was wrong to do it. And it's wrong for Donald Trump to be saying what he's saying right now. Now, we might not be in an election, but we're clearly in a very shifting moment in terms of governance. There is clearly, you know, an attempt by people like Boris Johnson to undermine the Prime Minister. And he's come in, he's plugged into that, and he's tried to influence it one way. So they seem to me not just comparable, but almost identical.
I disagree. Firstly, for the reason that I said about different rules apply when it's in the middle of an election campaign.
Although usually you don't interfere in the domestic politics
of the country you're visiting, do you? It's not domestic politics. It's a matter of importance for American trade policy as well as British domestic policy.
Yeah, I mean, I like this because it rests on this assumption that if Donald Trump were coming here and there was an election looming, he would observe this due protocol.
Well, that's another. Now we're back in bizarro world, I mean, think.
But, you know, yeah. Of course he would just completely, he breaks all those rules, and he does that all the time. And I thought, yes, here, well, the reason that he was doing that, it was true. It's a, you know, there is this point about American trade. I would say about that, by the way, that there is this fantasy that somehow, and Ian was talking before about the idea of this common rule book being somehow two equal mates, that this deal, that this wonderful deal that we would otherwise get with the United States would be this, you know, gentleman's agreement of two equals. What it would be is this, and we see this in all the way Trump operates, he would be the big guy and he would dictate to us the terms we would have to accept. That is how he approaches all deals, as a transaction of zero sum in which he gets the sum and you get zero. That's how we operate. So it's not some wonderful prize we're missing out on here. It's what we're missing out on is the right to be cornered by Trump in his usual bullying mode. And what he, of course, he doesn't like, the idea of Britain being part of the EU, because then the United States up against a bloc of 28 has to talk like equals and with a degree of parity. Otherwise, when it's a one-sided trade deal, we've seen the way he operates with his tariffs and with his transactional deals across the world. That's the big prize we're missing out on, is to be on the receiving end of a trumping. And that, believe me, is not a pleasant process. So I think that's there. But the other point is that he observes none of those protocols, and he has absolutely undermined the government he is visiting. And I think the idea that he would make a distinction between whether there was a vote coming or not, I'm afraid I don't think he would make any kind of distinction at all.
Ian. It's absolutely right. Like, there's really the question that we're facing with Brexit is not, do you want sovereignty and control? It is, do you want to be part of the European ecosystem in terms of trade and how that operates, including standards, or do you want to be part of the American one? Now, the truth is, I mean, Trump is obviously sort of more, you know, brutal and dreadful and just, you know, lacking in personal civility about the whole thing and more zero sum about it. But ultimately, any president would take the same approach.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say that's how the US always negotiates in trade deals. Yeah.
The way the farming lobby would operate, the way Silicon Valley would demand changes to data protection, the way the pharmaceutical industry would demand that we do something to change NICE. NICE and the NHS is a nightmare for US pharmaceuticals because it compares drug efficiency to price, which is like some terrible hell for them. So on all of these cases, you know, you're obviously going to see shifts there, and that would be part of the deal. If we're signed up, plugged into European standards, especially on agricultural products, that is a major obstacle. So the irony, of course, is that despite, you know, the grotesque way he goes about it and just the sheer lack of manners of him coming here and speaking that way about the Prime Minister, the content of what he's saying is absolutely accurate. By signing up to European standards, it means that the Americans have far less interest in doing a trade deal with you, and that is a good thing.
Let me just put one just slight caveat on that, which is, I think it's true any American president would obviously defend American industry and American manufacturers. The slight difference is that where Trump is different from Obama and indeed from other Republican presidents is his conception of trade as a zero-sum business.
Yeah, he's a protectionist.
He's a protectionist, exactly. And so previous American presidents, even Republicans, did believe that you could have some kind of win-win, that both economies did well when they traded with each other. He looks at trade surpluses and imbalances and immediately assumes somebody's getting screwed. And that isn't and has not been the approach, really, from in the post-war period. It's definitely got precedent going back into much earlier American history, but it hasn't been the mode in the post-war period, and that is the change.
Madeleine, how do you think Conservative voters will see Trump's intervention? Does this, at the margin, help? Does it strengthen Boris Johnson's argument? Well, it won't enthuse Guardian readers, but does it strengthen Boris Johnson's argument that this sort of Brexit doesn't deliver what voters wanted?
I don't consider myself a Conservative in the strictest sense. I would say that I think what Trump has voiced is definitely what a lot of grassroots conservatives would be feeling about the deal, that it's a bit of a damp squib and it's not leaving in a really meaningful way. I definitely don't think that the kind of, I suppose, the anti-American sentiment that pervades the intellectual classes is that common on a grassroots level generally. I think if you go outside of London, you meet lots of people who feel far more positively about Trump's visit, who feel more positively about the special relationship more generally.
Let's not confuse those two things, though, Trump and America. I don't think that the criticism of Trump is anti-Americanism. I do think when I was growing up, so when I was in university and sort of protesting against the Iraq War and all of that, I think lots of my fellow campaigners, and probably even myself, if I'm honest, like at certain times, flirted with sort of anti-Americanism. And I felt it then. I had an American cousin come over, and I remember walking through Paris during that period, and guys threw rocks at her as soon as they heard her accent. That's there. But that is not, I think, where we are right now. I don't see any trace of that. I thought the American embassy's sort of, so I think it was Republicans in London, actually, who put out a warning going, maybe you should be careful and be quiet if you're an American right now. It just seemed like complete nonsense to me. And I don't know if any Americans in London, I haven't heard any of them reporting back that kind of thing. I think the dislike of Trump is quite separate. And in fact, a lot of its moral force comes from this sort of astonishment that America, which is a country that always seems very polite when you go there and generally rather fair, is not conducting itself in that way and is electing someone who seems to define himself in opposition to that kind of behaviour.
Mm. Johnny, is there any other way of playing it for Theresa May? You know, you have this, different leaders have tried it differently, haven't they? They've tried sort of flattery. You know, is there any other approach she could have taken? And you know, were Labour in power? I mean, they've sort of suggested that they might rescind the invitation. Although at one time, I know Jeremy Corbyn said he'd take Trump to an Arsenal match. Not sure how that would have gone. But, you know, is there any other sort of playbook for this sort of president?
Well, there's the wouldn't start from here response, of course, which is that it was a huge mistake to give him the state visit invitation within a week. And I think, he has a kind of reptilian smell for weakness, and I think he saw that as weakness. And the way Macron played it, where he played hard to get a bit more, just in the, you know, the ridiculousness of the handshake and all that, it did seem to increase slightly Trump's respect for Macron at that beginning period. But the truth is, what you said, Blair, is right, that no approach has really worked with him. And it's the same when you read these accounts from his advisors or about his advisors and how difficult he is to manage. He is a classic bully where if you fawn and grovel, he doesn't respect you because he thinks you're weak. And then if you don't, he just responds and goes completely hostile. But the fantasy, I suppose, if she was only thinking of her domestic constituency, remains what I call the Love Actually stratagem, which is, you'll remember the Hugh Grant Prime Minister giving President Billy Bob Thornton in that movie a thorough dressing down, and just the cheers in the cinema, let alone within the story, for that approach. And if Theresa May, even in her very sort of coded sort of English way, was to talk back to Trump and just say, we are a proud country and we will make our own decisions, I think it could do her an enormous power of good. But I'm not holding my breath.
I think that might be as much of a unicorn as some of the solutions to the customs issues we were talking about earlier. Well, you can follow all of that and more at theguardian.com/politics. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Madeleine Grant, Ian Dunt, Jonathan Friedland and Matthew Goodwin. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.